Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Leanne Morrill, First Assistant Attorney General for the State of Colorado. In this proceeding, I represent the defendant's appellants, Colorado Secretary of State Scott Gessler, the Colorado Department of State, and the Director of the Elections Division for the Department of State, Judge Choate. It's never a good sign when the first words out of your mouth to an appellate court are an apology. But I would like to be the first to apologize to this court for the, the unusual procedural posture upon which this appeal rests. And I think the court's order requiring the parties to submit supplemental briefing on the issue of whether Rule 106A4 applies to an appeal under Section 1-1.5105(4) of the Election Code indicates that the court may be as puzzled by what is the correct process for an appeal under that provision of the Election Code as the parties clearly were in this proceeding. I think that what is clear based on what did happen in the trial court is that the parties proceeded down the road of an original proceeding in this case, meaning that after the complaint was filed and the secretary's motion to dismiss was granted in part and denied in part, that the parties then proceeded down the road towards a trial as opposed to an appeal. And that's evidenced in the record by the fact that after filing the answer, the case became at issue, the parties exchanged Rule 26A1 disclosures, and the court, at the request of the plaintiff, Ms. Marks, a trial setting conference was scheduled. And that trial setting conference was what triggered the, I think, realization by the trial court that it intended for its order denying the secretary's motion to dismiss to be a final judgment of all the claims in the case.
Ms. Morrill, let me ask you this. What were you going to try? What were the parties going to try? Because it looks to me like the fact-finding process was complete at the Secretary of State's level.
That's a good point, Your Honor. And in conferrals with counsel for Ms. Marks, the Secretary and the other state defendants indicated that their primary focus in any trial would largely be related to Ms. Marks' basis for believing that a violation of Title III of HABA occurred during the conduct of the 2010 general election in Sawatch County. As claimed in the complaint, Ms. Marks is a resident of Pitkin County, Colorado, and she's alleging violations of Title III of HABA that occurred in Sawatch County. And the secretary wanted to ascertain the basis for her belief that violations of HABA had occurred or were still occurring.
But is that appropriate in the trial court as opposed to before the Secretary of State?
I'm not sure I understand your honor.
Why is the trial court the finder of fact as to whether Ms. Marks believed there had been a violation? I thought the Secretary of State was supposed to do that.
Yes, Your Honor, and the Secretary of State did make a legal decision that Ms. Marks lacked standing because she had not personally suffered or witnessed a violation of Title III of HABA, and that was set forth in the letter that was sent to Ms. Marks notifying her that her administrative complaint had been dismissed. So the real issue is before the trial court, what was its task in considering the secretary's determination? And the parties proceeded down the course of an original proceeding and took it upon and put the issue in front of the trial court and were prepared to posture it in a way where the trial court would then make a new determination.
But when you say original proceeding, you mean trial de novo?
Not trial de novo, Your Honor. I mean original complaint proceeding where the plaintiff bears the burden by preponderance of evidence in a civil proceeding. The case has to be adjudicated on the merits in some type of final judgment that's appropriate for appellate review.
Then why did the Secretary of State have all of these procedures in place under the Colorado HAVA as far as what it was supposed to do and find?
Those procedures were mandated by federal law. HAVA requires every state that accepts federal funds for purposes of carrying out the requirements of HAVA to also enact a state administrative complaint procedure. And that's been done in Colorado. The General Assembly did so. And Ms. Marks brought her administrative complaint under that procedure. The secretary dismissed the complaint. And the question is whether his dismissal was improper under federal law, in part, as codified under state law as well in the administrative complaint procedure.
Well, as I read the way that the case is postured, the issue revolves around which statutory standing standard should apply. Do you agree with that?
Yes, I do agree with that, Your Honor. That is, in fact, the heart of this case.
Why is that a factual dispute as opposed to a legal question?
I think it can be determined as a matter of law. And in fact, at the time that the trial court issued the addendum to the order denying the motion to dismiss, my understanding was that plaintiffs were prepared to file or preparing to file a Rule 12C motion. So the secretary's contention as to the trial court's error is simply that it's improper under Colorado law for an order denying a motion to dismiss to grant summary substantive relief to the plaintiff in doing so.
Okay, could I back up
just a little bit before I move in? I think that in my mind, at least, that's kind of the next issue, but going back to what, if anything, was the final judgment that enables us to have jurisdiction, it sounds from the briefs as if both sides agreed after October that there was no final judgment at that time. Is that a fair statement?
That was my understanding, Your Honor. And I did have a conferral with Mr. McGuire, who represents Ms. Marks, and in which he said he thought that the order denying the motion to dismiss from October did in fact dispose of all the issues pending before the trial court. And myself and my co-counsel at the time explained to him that under Colorado law, an order denying a motion to dismiss is not a final and appealable order, and it doesn't dispose of the case or the claims before the court on the merits. It simply denies a defendant's jurisdictional arguments as why the case shouldn't proceed, or it says that I don't find that there's a failure to state the claim based on the facts alleged in the complaint.
Okay, my more specific question is, can the parties make something into a non-final order by thinking it's not a non-final order? In other words, does the construction that parties to litigation put on an order have any bearing in our assessment of the finality of that order?
I don't think that that's the argument that the secretary would advance. Rather, the one that we have advanced and stick by at this argument and in the briefs is that a trial court cannot declare something to be final, which is not final. And that's a matter of Colorado law.
Okay.
And so if the trial court wanted to dispose of the case and felt that it had grounds to do so, it needed to do so in some other format than an order denying a motion to dismiss. The Rule 12C motion that plaintiffs might have filed, cross motions for summary judgment, but all of that assumes that the review by the trial court in this case was not an appeal, that it was an original proceeding that would come and be litigated and go through discovery and be tried to the court if not disposed of on motions for summary judgment.
When you refer to original proceeding, then does that contemplate disregarding what happened in the administrative proceeding?
That's exactly right. And as if plaintiff, not liking the decision she got in the administrative court, the administrative process by the secretary, was coming into the Denver District Court at filing a whole new complaint and alleging her violations of HAVA and proceeding to prove up her allegations if she could first establish her standing, which the secretary did challenge and continues to challenge. So yes, that's what I mean by an original proceeding.
Well, then, if that's the case, why did the legislature use the term the complainant may appeal?
You're precisely right, Your Honor, and hence my apology, because I think that this court has honed in on what in fact was intended by the legislature, which is an appeal to the Denver District Court, not an original proceeding. And I, in large part, it was not the focus that the parties had. And it didn't come to anyone's attention until we got the addendum claiming to summarily remand the proceedings back to the secretary for further consideration. And so I'm taking the position before this court that the review under section 1-1.5, 105(4) should be an appeal, similar to an appeal under the Administrative Procedure Act, even though by its express terms, the statute makes certain that there is no adjudication for purposes of that act, or similar to an appeal under Rule 106(a)(4), meaning that at this stage, if we were to go back to the trial court today, if this court were to send us back, the secretary, there's a complaint has been filed, the secretary moved to dismiss, that's been granted in part, denied in part. We believe the dismissal of the 1983 claim was appropriate, as explained in the briefs. And then now what would happen, and the secretary has answered, so now the secretary would have to certify the record before him, the administrative proceeding, to the trial court, and the trial court would review the record, including the secretary's letter, which dismissed Ms. Mark's administrative complaint, not just for lack of standing, but also on the merits.
Well, I thought the determinative order was that she lacked standing, and oh, by the way, here's why your complaint would fail as well.
But that, oh, by the way, Your Honor, was 5 pages of some substantive analysis.
Isn't that pure dictum in legal jargon?
I would disagree with that characterization, Your Honor, only because the allegations in the administrative complaint were taken as true, but the analysis done was for failure to state a claim, meaning that no allegations of Title III of HAVA were actually alleged in the administrative complaint for which the secretary would be required to conduct a hearing and issue a decision. And that's all set forth very, at length in the letter.
Here's my question. Isn't the administrative record essentially before the district court?
That has not occurred yet, Your Honor. No. Ms. Mark's complaint is not a part of the record before the trial court, her administrative complaint. All that's pending before the trial court is her complaint to get into
the answer. And the answer that you filed.
And the answer that we filed, that's correct.
Based on the answer that you filed, it looks to me, in comparing the two, that the only disputes, if you can call them disputes, is whether she had standing or not. The secretary essentially admits everything that she alleged that occurred in the administrative process. There's no dispute about that.
There's no dispute about the procedural posture or the proceedings in the administrative process. However, the secretary does dispute that section 105(4), or I should say section 105 and the administrative procedures set forth under Colorado law in any way conflict with the requirements of HAVA for states' administrative procedures. I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Jeff Ains, registration number 44369, and I represent the plaintiff appellee and cross-appellant Marilyn Marks. May it please the court, it would be very easy to lose sight of the underlying substantive issues in this case, given the procedural complexities. But it must be remembered that the case concerns the ability of Colorado citizens to notify the Secretary of State of perceived HAVA violations. Frankly, it seems surprising that the Secretary would want to restrain such a service that the citizenry might provide to its government. But in this case, the government has sought to limit who can report such violations. Indeed, the government has sought to enforce a threshold for standing to bring complaints that no voter could meet with respect to perceived violations concerning voting equipment.
But isn't the secretary bound by the law, by the statute that's passed by the General Assembly?
Indeed, he is, Your Honor.
That's what the General Assembly said is required, correct?
But qualified by the conflict provision that exists, so that federal HAVA must be deferred to when there's a conflict.
Okay, so the secretary, though, is administering Colorado law, the Colorado HAVA statute, and trying to enforce that by saying the statute says you have to be personally aggrieved, you have to have personally witnessed or observed or been the victim of a violation.
That's right, and failing to recognize the conflict that poses with respect to federal HAVA, and therefore taking federal HAVA into account. The purpose of the HALA complaint procedure was to encourage the reporting and investigation of problems, and the government's position in this case runs contrary to that intended goal. There are essentially two substantive questions before this court. First, whether Ms. Marks has standing to bring her HALA complaint with the secretary and to have a dismissal of her complaint reviewed by the district court.
Excuse me, before we can, would you agree that before we can even address those substantive questions, we have to figure out if we have jurisdiction?
Yes, indeed.
Okay. Let's talk for just a moment about the issue that we spoke about with Ms. Morrell. First of all, in the district court, was it your position that the October order was a final judgment?
Yes, it was.
It was, okay. Then
in the October, the original,
the original,
not the addendum, yes. That it was a final judgment.
Okay.
But Ms. Marks was successful on the claims that she was most interested in.
So
the first and third claims for relief.
Okay.
And so it didn't make sense to appeal.
So, but you then subsequently proceeded to try to set the case for trial. I don't need to know every discussion that you had with opposing counsel, but I'm just trying to get my mind around whether the way this was treated in the district court has any bearing on our determination as to what, if anything, was the final order, final appealable order in this case.
Your Honor, we moved to dismiss the appeal because we believe that the court does indeed lack jurisdiction over this appeal. The addendum from which the government appealed wasn't an appealable final judgment. As you know, this court only hears appeals from final judgments, and the district court's order was the final judgment in this case. In terms of our moving forward to settle, to do a trial setting conference, that was largely because the defendants didn't accept the original order didn't indeed end the case, and so we're going to proceed along those lines nonetheless.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Baines, what about the fact that the trial court didn't specifically remand the matter in the original order to the Secretary of State? Simply made a determination or a declaration in your client's favor on two of the three claims, but said nothing more about remanding the matter for further proceedings. Does that make a difference?
Using the actual words remand,
I'd
have to pull up the... I don't think using the words remand should make a procedural difference. I think the original order, not having it in front of me right now, I can't quote you a verse from it, but the language was clear that the district court judge intended that the secretary should provide Ms. Marks with a hearing on this matter, and I think that's tantamount to saying that the case is remanded for that hearing.
Well, a declaratory judgment declares the rights of the parties, for example, but absent of some kind of enforcement order from a court saying, go henceforth and do this, it's really just a declaration, isn't it?
I suppose that's correct, Your Honor, but I would point to the idea that the intent can be discerned if the language wasn't as accurate as perhaps it could have been.
Well, the intent seems to be denying the motion to dismiss in part and granting it in part. That's what the order, in fact, says. It says, the order denying motion to dismiss when in fact it granted one of them. What are you to discern from the title of the order, if anything?
I'm not sure I understand it.
Well, the order that the court entered, as I recall, says it's an order denying a motion to dismiss. That's what it's called. It doesn't say final judgment. It doesn't say you get relief on two of your three and we're dismissing your other one. It just says order denying motion to dismiss. You get that kind of a pleading as a lawyer? Do you think that's a final order?
All right, well, again, I suppose, Your Honor, I would come back to the point about the notion that a hearing was, that the judge indicated that a hearing was deserved on Ms. Marks' administrative complaint.
Okay.
As I was saying, there are two substantive questions before the court. In addition, there's a procedural question before the court, and that's whether the court's sua sponte grant of relief to Ms. Marks was appropriate in light of the procedural posture. I was going to address the substantive questions first. The government has argued Ms. Marks lacks standing to seek judicial review under federal law. Indeed, the government has said that Ms. Marks' claim for relief rises and falls on whether she has standing to bring a complaint for judicial review of the Secretary's dismissal of her administrative complaint under federal law. And the government spilled a large amount of ink analyzing standing under federal law for judicial review. But this argument is a red herring, because the analysis of Ms. Mark's standing under federal law is simply irrelevant here. Ms. Mark's standing must be analyzed under state law. The problem here, and what has opened the door to the government taking this position, is that the Colorado statutory provision on which Ms. Marks had to rely for standing to bring her administrative complaint was itself flawed because it conflicts with HAVA. In other words, Colorado's state implementation of the standing provision for administrative complaints from HAVA was flawed. It was too restrictive. While HAVA required the states to provide standing to any person who believes that there was a violation of Title III, Colorado implemented a more stringent standard, requiring that complainants would have standing only if they had either been personally aggrieved or personally witnessed a violation. Thus, Ms. Marks does not rely on federal law for her standing to bring an administrative complaint or to seek judicial review. She instead relies on federal law to challenge the propriety of the state law on which she must rely for standing to bring her administrative complaint. What the government seems to be asserting is that Ms. Marks' standing to bring her administrative complaint must be determined by reference to a flawed state statute, yet judicial review of the flawed state statute must be analyzed under federal law. But that defies logic. Ms. Marks' reliance on the federal standing provision of HAVA is necessary only to establish that Colorado's state statute regarding standing for administrative complaints conflicts with HAVA.
Counsel, let's assume for purposes of my question only that we agree with you that federal law controls. If the federal statute controls, then all Ms. Marks had to do was allege that she believed there had been a violation of the law, correct?
That's correct.
Does that automatically confer standing to bring an appeal?
No, the judicial review, the standing determination for judicial review would be a function of state law and would be analyzed under Wimberley.
So even if she had standing to bring a complaint, you would agree with the government that she has to show separate judicial standing in order to appeal this matter to the district court?
Yes, I would.
You don't think the statute that allows somebody who loses in the administrative process to automatically appeal confirms immediate standing?
I think you would still conduct the analysis to determine her, but the injury in fact would not be the injury in fact would be Lou's denial of, you know, of her right to have her administrative complaint heard. The General Assembly anticipated the conflict between federal HAVA and Colorado's implementation of HAVA, and it provided a reconciliatory device that could be employed in a conflict situation like this. And the federal statute trumps. So as I was saying, with respect to judicial review, under Wimberley, a plaintiff has to allege she suffered an injury in fact, and that the injury in fact was to a legally protected interest as contemplated by statutory or constitutional provisions. And this two-part test in Colorado has been relatively easy to satisfy historically. The first part of the test is satisfied here because Ms. Marks suffered an injury in fact when she was denied the ability to file an administrative complaint and receive a hearing on the record regarding that complaint, despite having satisfied the proper statutory requirement for standing to bring a complaint. Ms. Marks also satisfies the second part of the Wimberley test. The Supreme Court has held that legally protected rights encompass all rights arising from constitution, statutes, and case law. Here, Ms. Marks had a legally protected right to file an administrative complaint with the Secretary because she believed that a violation of Title III of HAVA had occurred. This right derives from HAVA itself, or it derives from Colorado's implementation of HAVA, assuming, again, that the General Assembly's conflict-resolving mechanism was respected and employed in this case. Or it derives from both the state law and federal law. In any event, Ms. Marks is satisfied with the problems of the Wimberley test for standing in Colorado. I'd like to turn to the 1983 issue. The district court dismissed Ms. Marks' second claim for relief. That claim sought under 42 U.S. Code 1983 to vindicate federally secured rights to file an administrative complaint under HAVA and to receive a hearing on the record. and to receive an ancillary award of fees under 1988. In dismissing her second claim, the district court relied on the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Will for the proposition that neither states nor state officials acting in their official capacities are persons within the meaning of Section 1983. And it dismissed Ms. Marks' claim against both the Department of State and the Secretary and Defendant Shoaf. But the district court's reading of Will was overly broad, because the holding in Will came in the context of damages claims. And as the court noted in Will, albeit in dicta, a state official when sued in their official capacity for injunctive relief is a person for purposes of 1983, because actions for prospective relief are not treated as actions against the state.
I think your opponent sort of agrees with you on that, don't they?
They do indeed, Your Honor.
Okay. And so that point is the point that the Secretary and Defendant Shoaf are persons for purposes of 1983 has been conceded.
Tell me what specific language in the subsections dealing with the right to a hearing and the standing gives your client a federal right within the meaning of the Blessing case that would allow her to sue under 1983.
So the three-part test in Blessing is, did Congress intend that the provision would benefit the plaintiff? Is the right not so vague and amorphous that its enforcement would strain judicial competence? And does the statute unambiguously impose a binding obligation on the states? You know, Ms. Marks has not predicated her claim on a blanket assertion. She's identified two specific individual rights: the right to file an administrative complaint and the right to receive a hearing on the record.
Well, we need to look specifically at the language of the provisions, correct? The language of the federal HAVA provisions?
That provide those,
yes.
Those two rights,
and
yes.
My question is, based on Section 15.512 of HAVA, what language there grants a federal right as opposed to a benefit or an interest, which is what we're supposed to look at under the first prong of Blessing?
Bear with me.
Sure.
Direct the court to 15.512 A2B and A2E.
Okay.
As the provisions that create a federal right to.
All right. B says, if under the procedures, a person who believes there's a violation may file a complaint. What in that language provides a federal right? It's permissive, may file a complaint. Does that grant a right?
I believe it does, Your Honor, because it vests the power to choose to file a complaint with the complainant and not with the secretary in terms of his ability to hear it or not hear it. So it is permissive, but permissive with respect to the complainant's ability.
Okay, isn't it different from language such as that? Let me finish this and you can respond. Isn't it different from language from some of the federal cases that talks about, for example, under the Title IX provisions, no person shall be discriminated against? It focuses on the person, whereas here, under sub 1, it says if a state receives any payment from the federal government, the state shall comply with the following. Does that differentiate in your mind at all?
Again, it doesn't, Your Honor, precisely because it vests the ability in the complainant both to file a complaint if they choose to do so, or they can choose not to do so if they're not required to. But it doesn't give any discretion with respect to the secretary. Once the state has accepted power funds, there isn't discretion to choose to accept or reject these complaints. And again, I would just leave it at that.
Okay. We've taken a lot of your time here this afternoon, counsel. I think we'll be happy to give you each 5 more minutes if you'd like to have it.
Thank you, Your Honor. Shall I continue?
With respect to the issue of this sua sponte grant of relief, the district court, in response to the motion to dismiss Ms. Marks' first and third claims, granted sua sponte relief to Ms. Marks. And in doing so, relied on APA jurisprudence, in particular, Board of Assessment Appeals. Now, the government has argued that such relief was inappropriate in that procedural context. But such relief was entirely appropriate, both because of the absence of any dispute over material facts, and because the parties were given ample opportunity to be heard on the law. And frankly, this would be true regardless of the basis on which the district court reached its conclusion.
So, if I understand you correctly, you're saying that even if the district court cited the wrong case or heard in referring to the APA, it still had the power to enter the sort of order it did by virtue of its power as a court of general jurisdiction, or by virtue of its power under the rules of civil procedure.
Your Honor, I think the court was operating in a bit of a precedential void. This appeal came under 1.5.1054, and there are cases that dictate how judicial review is meant to occur in that situation. I think the appropriate thing for the court would have been either to refer to the APA for guidance, if not, we would argue that APA precedent should be binding, but even if it wasn't binding, the court should have referred to its ability, what it could have done under the APA, and also, as Your Honor has suggested through asking for the supplemental brief, by referring to 106A4, and I think under both sets of areas of law, the real issue is, are there any questions of fact in front of the court, and if there aren't, the court should be able to make a decision on the law and remand the case back to the administrative tribunal.
So, in this case, I asked the question of your opposing counsel, or maybe I asked it to you, it's been too long now. Was the administrative record essentially complete? I mean, what you had the letter from the secretary dismissing the complaint based on standing, and then it had some other provisions talking about the merits of the issue.
I would agree with Ron, at least in the way you phrased your question before. I think the discussion of the merits was dicta. I think there was no hearing, so Ms. Marks didn't have an opportunity to be heard. So I think the record was incomplete on that point. On the point that was in front of the district court, whether Ms. Marks had standing to bring her administrative complaint, the only relevant fact was a tick-the-box type question as to whether she believed the violation of HAVA had occurred. And I think that was clear in the record. But aside from that, at least your question of law.
Okay. Is it enough for, under your theory, for a person to simply come into the administrative proceeding and say, I believe that this violation occurred? Or, as opposing counsel, I believe, suggested, is it necessary to go behind that statement and examine whether this person really believed in or had a basis for such belief? I had understood Ms. Morrell to say that there was a remaining factual dispute concerning the basis for Ms. Marks' belief that there had been a violation. Do you have to look into that, or do you have to? Does the tribunal have to accept the plaintiff's statement, I believe there was a violation?
I think in drafting federal law, the language is pretty direct and refers only to the complainant's belief. I suppose an administrative tribunal could try to establish what someone believed, but I feel as though that might be a difficult endeavor to set out on. I think the question is, does the complainant come forward and say that they believe it? That should be sufficient. If I could just address again, Rule 106A4. The court requested, I think, if you were to review Rule 106A4 and its application to this case, you would get to the same result that I described if you would follow the Administrative Procedures Act jurisprudence. This court would find that a plain, speedy, adequate remedy was not available to Ms. Marks under 101.5.1054 and or the APA, that you'd get to the same outcome. Because In reviewing administrative agency decisions under Rule 106A4, courts consider whether the agency abused its discretion or exceeded its jurisdiction, as well as whether it applied an erroneous legal standard. The district court's review would be necessarily limited to questions of law, and it would be prohibited, actually, from conducting any fact-finding in this case. And accordingly, as I mentioned, the district court's decision on the first and third claims for relief involved pure questions of law, which means that the analysis under 106A4 or the APA would proceed identically. And the district court's decision could be upheld on either basis.
But not, it's, you singled out the first and the third claims for relief. What about the 1983 claim? Was that a pure question of law?
It was a pure question of law with respect to whether Ms. Marks had a federal right. I think the fact question would be what fees she was entitled to under 1988.
Thank you, Mr. Baines.
Thank you.
Ms. Morrell, I promise not to take all of your time, but I have one question that's been sort of haunting me here.
Absolutely.
Assume for purposes of the question only that we were to agree that federal law controls Ms. Marks' standing.
Yes, Your Honor.
If that's the case, then would you still contend that she had no right, she didn't have standing, rather, to bring a complaint in district court or not? For appeal.
Yeah, for appeal. And that's the important distinction, Your Honor, because any person who believes is enough to get you the ability to file the administrative complaint. That's under HAVA, that's the question about whether there's conflict between any person who suffered or personally witnessed under state law. But even under similar federal statutory schemes, such as the Federal Election Campaign Act, this is the Antosh case that is discussed at length in the Secretary's briefs, the courts who analyze a party's standing to challenge the denial of an administrative complaint based on any person who believes is held to a higher standard. You don't get to invoke the jurisdiction of a true court tribunal unless you've been aggrieved by the denial of your administrative complaint. And in this case, Ms. Marks has not been aggrieved. She has not been injured in any sense of the word. And the facts of Antosh are so parallel to the facts of this case, where in Antosh, you had a resident of Oklahoma who read about or heard about what was going on in Arizona, didn't like it, filed a complaint with the Federal Elections Commissions under the Campaign Act, challenging what was going on in Arizona. He believed that there was a violation of the act, so he filed a complaint. The complaint was denied. He then filed, as a person aggrieved, he tried to file an action for judicial review in federal district court. And the court said, no. Under injury, in fact, to a legally protected interest, you must, in fact, have been injured by the denial of your administrative complaint. And in that case, you're a public-spirited observer of elections and campaign finance practices in Oklahoma. Doesn't get you an injury to when somebody's not running their campaign correctly in Arizona. And that's what we have here with Ms. Marks.
But then that's the federal standing. I mean, don't we all agree that federal standing is substantially different from state standing?
Well, Your Honor, the analysis that we've offered is not reliant on prudential standing considerations, which is a major. The zone of interest analysis is not one that we're advocating that this court needs to adopt in ruling on whether Ms. Marks has standing to pursue her the dismissal of her administrative complaint in state court. In fact, we're not urging this court to adopt anything other than the fact that there are federal cases under parallel statutory schemes that are highly instructive on the issue of whether Ms. Marks has been injured. And the Antosh case is precisely one of those. So and the other thing I would point out to this court, which I think is really, really important to keep in mind, is that Ms. Marks, as she said in her briefs, and I think she said in the actual administrative complaint, she alleges all sorts of personal interests, right? The personal interest in having accurate reporting as a resident of the state of Colorado and registered elector. She has a personal interest in accurate reporting of election results in all of Colorado's 64 counties. Not just the one in which she votes, which is Pitkin County, but in Sawatch in the 2010 general election. And based on that interest, she's injured if she believes, despite not having personally suffered any injury to her right to vote, or having personally witnessed somebody else suffer that injury, that she has the ability to challenge what goes on in another county in which she doesn't reside and she doesn't vote. Now let's contrast that fact, that scenario, which is at issue in this case, with what HAVA was really meant to protect. Under HAVA, it's required that every voting center have a voting system that would accommodate a disabled individual and enable them to vote in a manner in which their vote is private and that they can vote independently. Now, somebody who tried to vote in the Sawatch County election in 2010 who was disabled, if those rights had been violated, they should file a HAVA complaint. They should come before the district court challenging the dismissal of that complaint. They've been aggrieved. But that didn't happen, and that's not what happened in this case. So I really caution the court before accepting Ms. Mark's version of standing, because what it will do is open the door to all sorts of people who have personal interests and personal beliefs in how elections are run in the state of Colorado. And that's a slippery slope that I think courts should avoid. With my remaining 2 minutes, I would like to address the 1983 claim. So I think Your Honor was on the right track with the questions posed to Mr. Baines about whether HAVA can in any way be conceived of as creating enforceable federal rights as opposed to the ability procedurally to file a complaint. The Secretary feels very strongly that that is not a federal right. It's a process that's mandated by federal law and codified by state law, but it is not a source of substantive rights. And this issue was squarely addressed in a case involving Title III and HAVA violations that were alleged in Ohio. And it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and in Bruner v. Ohio Republican Party, the Supreme Court rejected the Court of Appeals' entry of a temporary restraining order against the Secretary of State in a Section 1983 case, saying that it didn't believe that the plaintiffs would be able to prevail under their chosen theory. And it's precisely because HAVA, like the Federal Education Privacy Act, is focused on what states must do and must not do, not on what rights individuals have. And I think the court acknowledged that when it was questioning Mr. Baines about where is the language, where is the shall not discriminate, where is the you have the right to bear arms, where is you have the right to engage in political association. This is just a process. The denial of that process does not bring down the weight of federal Section 1983 jurisprudence. We would ask that the court remand this case to the trial court with instructions to conduct further proceedings consistent with an appeal. Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. This case will stand submitted. We will issue a written opinion to you in due course.